Good evening. And I guess this is the last of the pre-winter sessions. I think Gurion was here as part of the group for my first year, maybe two. I know I was, even though I knew he hadn't been coming around, that was still a surprise for me. But I think it would be appropriate to dedicate some of the learning this evening in his memory. The topic for the evening continues our theme of new issues, but it's a different kind of new issue, in the sense that the first one that we dealt with was a new issue in law, and that was the issue of recreational marijuana use. I saw an article actually just last night. It was on CNN's website. It said Canada stands to make billions on legal marijuana use. They're not looking at how much is going to have to be spent to deal with things. They're just looking at the profit. Yeah. But that was one. And then the second one that we dealt with, we talked about gene editing. And that's a new technology and what that enables. So this time I wanted to look at a different kind of new issue, and really it's about new philosophy and new psychology, a little bit about new technology also, and that's the issue of, as I titled it on your sheet, modern medicine, patient autonomy, and terminal diagnosis. The old issue is the question of, so how do you give somebody the worst kind of bad news? How do you tell somebody that... That the doctors believe there's nothing more that they can do in order to treat. That's a very old issue, and as we'll see, it's been dealt with for a very long time in the literature. But there are changes in secular society and changes in philosophy, changes in medicine, changes in law, all of which have led to a change in the secular practice, what goes on in the medical world in terms of what they do and when they tell and how they tell. And so you have to ask the question in Judaism of, so how does Judaism look at this? What do we believe ought to be done? And so I wanted to show you the contrast between what used to be and what is by showing you source number one. Those who actually saw what I sent you on the in the email, I actually accidentally sent you my notes as well as the source sheet. So you've got the whole the whole session already in front of you. Yeah, I can go home and the Gibbons can give the class. This is from 1868, the Canadian Medical Association's first code of ethics. It was actually, frankly, largely ripped off from the American Medical Association's first code of ethics, which was from 1840-something, and they're almost word for word the same on most of what they do. But we won't hold that against them. If you take a look at source number one, the very beginning, physicians should unite tenderness with firmness and condescension with authority. I think condescension meant a different thing in 1868 than it means today. And thus inspire their patients with gratitude, respect, and confidence. Okay? Be tender but firm with the patient. Be condescending. Come down to their level, but with authority. Well, look at the next one. A physician should studiously avoid making gloomy prognostications as they savor of empiricism. Anyone familiar with empiricism?
I don't know what it means.
Right. So I didn't either. I had to look it up.
What it means, what you see.
Right. See, usually, we actually view... Sorry? Well, it's what's observed. It's based on the data. And it's funny because today, we very much value an empirical approach. But in those days, an empirical approach meant... I, as a physician, have the following anecdotal evidence, and I'm going to draw my conclusions based on that, as opposed to based on theory. And there was this kind of very sharp divide between the empiricists and the rationalists. And the medical establishment says, well, we don't want any empiricists. We don't want you telling us what you've observed. Give me what the scientific theory says. That's the new wave of 1868. So they don't want you to make predictions, because predictions look like you're extrapolating, well, I saw this patient, and this patient lived this long, and now I think that's going to be the case here. No, no, no. And it magnifies the importance of his services to the treatment of the disease. So don't make these predictions. But he should not fail on proper occasions to give to the friends of the patient timely notice of danger when it really occurs, and even to the patient himself if absolutely necessary. Tell the friends, but avoid telling the patient. Don't tell the patient. That's correct. And there's actually, I didn't bring the whole thing here, but there's a discussion about, you know, finding friends who can be the ones to break the news, and the physician shouldn't be involved in breaking the news. And then the last one here. Sorry? Here it does not include the family. That is correct. I suspect because they're concerned about the family being too emotional. We're going to see that in Jewish sources on this as well. The concern that the family is so overcome with emotion, it's bad for the patient. The friends, hopefully, are objective. So the next paragraph I brought you just because it's too much fun not to. The obedience of a patient to the prescriptions of his physician should be prompt and implicit. He should never permit his own crude opinions as to their fitness to influence his attention to them. A failure in what's that, doctor? A failure in one particular may render an otherwise judicious treatment dangerous and even fatal. This remark is equally applicable to diet, drink, and exercise. As patients become convalescent, they are very apt to suppose the rules prescribed for them may be disregarded, and the consequences but too often is a relapse. So you better make sure. Sorry.
Do your physio.
Yes, do your physio is exactly right. You pay attention and you listen to what the doctor tells you, and don't you dare have your own crude opinion. That's the
empirical evidence.
Right, precisely. That's the world of 1868. You don't tell the patient anything you can get away with not telling the patient. Tell the patient this is what you do, this is how you do it, this is when you do it, and I'll see you next time. Well, take a look at source number two, which is today's policy from the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Ontario. Respect for the autonomy and personal dignity of the patient is central to the provision of ethically sound patient care. Through the translation of these ethical principles to law, the Supreme Court of Canada has confirmed the fundamental right of the individual to decide which medical interventions will be accepted and which will not. Total opposite. It's the patient who's going to make this decision, and frankly, it doesn't matter what the patient knows.
Yeah. What's the date on that?
That's now. That's current. This is the current rule. When it was actually drafted, I think in the last 10 years.
So this is assuming that the patient has all the information.
So no. Either that or the patient doesn't care. In other words,
how does the patient make a decision with on what grounds?
And the answer is the way most of us get through life.
No. I'm not talking about here. I'm talking about here.
No, I know.
What are they telling us?
Right, and the answer is they want the physician to inform the patient, and they are working with the assumption that the patient is going to come away from whatever conference he or she has with the physician armed with enough information to be able to make a reasonable decision. Right. And if the patient says, you know what, I'm just winging it, there's nothing the physician can do about it.
Right.
What's the liability of the doctor if he doesn't tell the patient everything and the patient goes on and makes a decision based on incomplete information?
And the answer is everything from sanction, loss of license, financial penalties, all depends on what you can convince the judge of just how bad this is and what country you live in. Right? In the U.S., there's far greater legal vulnerability than there's going to be in Canada. But either way, and we're going to see, that's part of what drives the change, is the fear of lawsuit. But I did this session in a different format for physicians last week, and there was somebody there who works in palliative care who was very upset. He said the patient has to be informed, the patient can't make a decision without knowing, and talking about the idea of a patient saying, you know what, I don't want to know, which patients often will say, he said, you can't not know. If you're going to make a decision, you have to be informed, to which we're going to see a response a little bit later. So I don't want to give you what's going to be in another little bit now. But it's not so simple and straightforward. You can already conclude just logically. You walk into a hospital room. You tell the patient, something about cancer or something about heart problems or whatever it is, you think that means the patient is now educated? You think the patient is now equipped and armed and able to make decisions because they had a 10-minute conference with a doctor who showed them an X-ray and
especially when they're upset.
Yeah, and they're upset and they're on potentially on painkillers and who knows what. And okay, you have an hour. You can make up your mind now.
But usually they have to sign something saying that they have been told the risks and all this.
You bet. Well, that goes back to the legal issue.
But the palliative guy, if he didn't feel what he said that, what he said to be so, could not work in his field, because I think that's a precondition in palliative care.
Yeah.
That they have to know.
Right, and it's a problem.
So if he doesn't believe that, he can't work in that field.
Well, he believes that he has to tell them.
Well, he has to.
But the patient often doesn't want to know. I don't know what he does in that circumstance.
But then the patient
can't
go into palliative care.
Or his, at any rate. So let's go through this. Let's go through this carefully and figure out what's changed. What happened between 1868 and the 21st century? What drives the change? And how that affects what happens in Judaism. So there are two basic points that are driving this. The first is the issue of patient autonomy. And the second is the sense that bad news is dangerous for a patient's health. So, as we'll see, the first point is patient autonomy. Historically, the idea in Jewish sources, the idea in general in society, we've already seen it here, was that authority rests with the educated doctor. The authority is not with the patient. From a Jewish perspective, in Jewish sources, that was certainly so. So that the Talmud discusses the case of somebody who's weak on Yom Kippur, and the doctor says, you can't fast. And the patient says, I can make it through. The answer is no, you're obligated to eat. You're responsible to follow the advice of the physician. Ramban Nachmanides, in source number 3, gives you the means by which we evaluate opinions when trying to decide what to do. And it says, if the doctors on each side are of equal number, we follow the more wise and expert. Right? We try to figure out who's got the better training, who has better experience, and that's who we're going to go with. But where it's 2 versus 1, since all of them are doctors and they know this craft, the position of one is nothing against the two. We're going to go with the majority. But then he goes back and he says, but where he is greater in wisdom, if the one is greater in wisdom, then we're concerned for his words to be strict, even against the majority. In other words, it's all about physician opinion, experience, training. That's what's going to guide this. Nowhere does he say, well, the patient can just decide, I think I'd like to follow this one versus that one. It simply wasn't on the radar screen as part of the conversation. One more source to support this, source number 4, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, jumping ahead in time. That was 13th century, this is 18th century. With an illness or visible wound for which a doctor has certain knowledge and clear understanding, and he prescribes a tested, complete treatment, we certainly compel a recalcitrant patient if the alternative would be dangerous. He says, the patient says, I don't want it. We tell him, too bad. Now, this doesn't mean that we're going to tie them up and inject them, right? Compel still doesn't mean physical coercion. That's generally assumed to be a bad idea. But what it means is we're going to do what Jews have always done, which is we're going to nudge them. And we'll call the rabbi and get the rabbi to nudge them. And eventually they're going to give in just because they're miserable. And we'll convince them that this is in their best interest. That's what we do. The Jewish version of compulsion. But that's that was the standard approach historically to the idea of patient autonomy. You don't have autonomy. You're going to do what the doctor says to do. There have been various views that limited this autonomy to a certain extent. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, it's beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about tonight, but Rabbi Herschel Schachter from Yeshiva University is of the opinion, based on the Talmud, that actually when it comes to end-of-life situations, a person is entitled to say, I want this, I don't want that, and that's consistent with Jewish tradition. Even if they say, I don't want, about things that we consider basic necessities of life, assuming that a normal person on the street might indeed decline those things, a person would be entitled to say, I don't want. So there is a possibility of some level of autonomy there. But generally speaking, authority is with the doctor. Clear? That's the history. I'm not in modern day yet. Right now I'm just giving you history of the Jewish position. Second, historically, the view was that bad news is indeed bad for your health. So when I said that before, I already heard people smile and laugh. You don't think so? You think? Yeah. It's sort of intuitive to people that bad news is bad for your health. But I'll show you a couple of passages from the Talmud that support the contention. One is source number 5, which unfortunately happens from time to time. There was actually a case in the community with this past week involving someone. You probably know them. If a patient's relative dies, we don't inform him of the death, lest his mind be torn, lest he become upset. So even though theoretically they should be sitting Shiva, we're not going to inform them of this if it could hurt their health. Yeah, that's one example. Another example of this is source number 6. Normally in Jewish law, if you want to engage in a transaction, you want to give something as a gift to somebody, you want to sell something, there's a formal act that has to be performed. It's called a kinyan. Right? It means an act of transaction. So even if it's as simple as a handshake in certain contexts, or it's giving someone something symbolic, or writing up a document, there has to be an execution of a transaction. If I simply make a declaration, I want to give my fill-in-the-blank to so-and-so, that's not a valid gift under the law. Normally it doesn't work that way. However, in the case of someone who's on their deathbed, then we accept their verbal statement, and that is already sufficient. And that's what I brought you in source number 6. The speech of a person on his deathbed has the legal force of written and transmitted wishes. Why? What's the rationale?
His last wish.
Right, but therefore what?
Time. Time's running out.
But it's not...
can't write.
Right. But it's not about the inability. There's something else.
You can't argue with them about it. There isn't time to discuss it.
Nope. I mean, it's true. But the legal consideration is the patient being upset, and you potentially abbreviate the person's life because he's so agitated that no one's listening to him and he's not able to execute what he wants to execute. So we say, in order to at least mitigate his anxiety, we're going to accept what he says.
So there'd be a witness?
Yeah, yes. You'll always need witnesses. It can't just be my say-so that they gave me $25 million. That doesn't work that way. The cases happen, but you need a witness to that effect. But the idea is we're concerned about the impact on them of the feeling of I can't do what I need to do, and therefore we take care of that stress. We alleviate that stress by approving their actions. Yeah.
The problem with that is their cognitive condition may be such that they're not really capable or, you know, first of all, they're on drugs if they're at end of life, usually. But there are, you know, a lot of people who don't have their cognitive condition in good shape.
Correct. So this is assuming that they pass the sound mind test.
Oh, okay.
This is talking about where they're entirely rational.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's often not the case.
Correct. And that's another factor that has to be weighed, you know, in dealing with these circumstances in general. More so now than when this was written 2,000 years ago when, you know, morphine wasn't really an option. In source number 7, I brought you one more case, which is just a funny case. But it fits the paradigm. One who wishes to embark, so wants to go on a trip, and wishes to know whether he will return home or not. Hey, you want to know, how's my trip going to go? Am I going to be safe? So here's what you do. Stand in a darkened house. If he sees a shadow of a shadow, meaning that either the shadow casts a shadow, which I don't think can happen, or some level of detail within the shadow is more likely what this means, he may know that he will return home. It's some kind of cultural...
Black magic.
Yeah, it's not magic. It's some kind of a cultural belief.
Superstition.
Yeah. It's some kind of a cultural belief that was present, you know, I mean, Maimonides has already written at length that one need not accept this sort of thing, it's providing what people did 2,000 years ago. It's not, there's no stamp of scripture on this recommendation. But it's also not the point. The point is what comes next. After telling us about this method, the Talmud says don't do it. He might become upset and his mazel might be harmed. Right? Because what happens if you don't see the shadow of a shadow? You get all upset. And now what? Yeah, the Talmud is of two minds regarding this sort of thing. They tell the story in another passage in the Talmud about dream interpretation. And even as one passage there says dream interpretation is a joke, the interpreter will say whatever he wants, at the same time they say, yeah, and it's going to come true anyway because it plays on your mind, and that's what leads you to self-fulfilling prophecies. I don't want to get caught up in the shadow of a shadow discussion. The point is, bad news can influence you. That was the traditional way to look at the world, and it had practical applications. So if you like number 7, you're going to really like number 8, especially about half the people in the room. From the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Talking about a practice we're going to come back to called the deathbed confession. In Hebrew, it's called vidui. There's a practice which we'll have to talk about that people, before they pass away, will actually recite, like on Yom Kippur, they'll recite vidui to acknowledge before God whatever they've done wrong. This doesn't, you know, this isn't like the rite with a priest. No one else needs to hear a person do it. It's personal, between that person and God. However, what the Code of Jewish Law talks about is the concern that the visitor knows that it's time for the patient to do this. The visitor says to the patient, it would be wise for you to do this. Now, we'll talk about how one might say that to a patient, because obviously, if you're talking about not wanting to let them know bad news, how do you advise them to do vidui? We're going to come back to that. But what he says here is, when you're talking to the patient about it, we don't speak of all of this, this whole deathbed confession, in front of the unlearned, in front of women, or in front of children, lest they cry and break his heart. Why those?
About the patient himself?
So again, we have to talk about how you tell the patient. We'll get to that. But right now, just talk about the other people who are present. The concern is that women and children are more apt to cry. Those who are not learned don't realize they're not supposed to get all upset in front of him, and that may be bad for him, for his health. Yes, it is true that men can cry as well, but in the 16th century they didn't. Yes, but you don't want to do anything that will make things worse.
That's what the idea. The
Sorry, what if the patient is?
A guy.
What can you do? She has to deal with it, but we'll talk about it. Again, we're really going to come back to how this conversation goes, because there's advice on that. Or a child. And if it's a child, the child doesn't need to do the vidui anyway. The child is underage and not responsible for anything. But the concern is that the witnesses who are present are potentially going to harm the patient's mood. The last source I brought you on this, bringing it into the 20th century, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, talked about the issue of choosing between patients. What do you do in terms of triage? Right? There's a multiple casualty event, and you have to decide whom you're going to treat. Well, it's one thing to say, what we logically say is, first treat the ones who you know you can save, right? Rather than investing your resources in the ones you can't save, and then nobody makes it. So that's a logical way to do triage. But what happens to the guy who's lying there and who sees that no one's paying any attention? He sees that everybody's given up on him. So Rabbi Feinstein talks about this in source number 9, and he says you have to do it in such a way that the dangerously ill patient will not know the doctors think that they cannot heal him. If it would cause him to know that they cannot heal him, he would be frightened. This would hasten his death. His mind would be torn, and that's always prohibited. So that concern of bad news harming the patient's health continues into modern times. And if that means you have to lie in order to avoid that, we're good with that idea. We're good with the idea that you don't tell the patient things that are going to harm the patient's health. And that goes even as far as cases that have been asked of rabbis. We have it in the literature where the patient says to the doctor, tell me, you know, am I going to recover? And the doctor says, yes, you're going to recover. And the patient says, I don't believe you. I want you to swear. And the doctor is told he's allowed to swear. He's told he's actually allowed to swear. I'll give you one that's really funny. I mean, this is all funny in a very dark sense.
You know, but it's very close to home, so...
Yeah. You know what the word in Hebrew is for cancer?
Sartan.
Sartan, correct. What does sartan also mean?
The crab.
The crab, right. Just like, you know, cancer has the zodiac symbol and all that, right? So the one rabbi who was asked about this, the question was, can you tell the patient that this is what they have? And he felt not to tell the patient. And he says, what do you do if the patient says, I want you to swear that I don't have sartan? So he says, you can do that. Can you have in mind that sartan doesn't mean cancer? Sartan means a crab. You don't have crab. That's
not too ethical.
Yeah. Well, it is ethical, actually. The argument they make is a very interesting one. Rabbi J. David Bleich, who's a leading authority in medical ethics in New York today, offers the following fascinating justification. Hugo Grotius was a Dutch thinker who said, you're never allowed to lie. Always have to tell the truth. A very extreme position. So he was asked, what if somebody comes up to you and says, where is your gun? I'd like to take it and use it against you. Do you now have to tell him where it is? And his answer was no. Well, how do you justify that? So he came up with a justification, not self-interest. His justification is because that person is not entitled to that information. So Rabbi Bleich argues the same thing is applicable here. You're not entitled to information that could harm your health. That's the logic. We find this, I didn't want to turn this into a class about lying because that's a fun topic, but we'd never get back to this. There's so much more to say about that kind of an approach. But this historically was the Jewish position, and so you have biblical cases even of not telling people. Take a look at source number 10. This relates to the prophet Elisha. Elisha was the student of Elijah. Hazael is the general of the nation of Aram. Okay, Aram are neighbors of the Jewish people. They live in what is today Syria. So the king of Aram is a fellow named Ben-Hadad. His general is Hazael. Ben-Hadad becomes sick. And he sends his general to the Jewish prophet Elisha, who is famous for his miracle working. And Hazael came and stood before Elisha and said, your son, it's an expression of deference, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, has sent me to you, saying, shall I die of this illness? And Elisha said to him, go tell him you shall surely live. But then he says, God has shown me he's going to die. But don't tell him that. Tell him that he is going to live. Don't give him the bad news. In another story, a prophet does give the bad news. This is a story of King Chizkiah. Chizkiah was one of the greatest kings we had. He's the king at the time that the Assyrians invaded and exiled the northern tribes. He's the king of the southern kingdom based in Jerusalem. And at one point he becomes ill. And the prophet Isaiah, comes to him and says to him, well, you'll see it. Take a look at source number 11. This is a midrash on the passage from the book of Kings. When Chizkiah became ill, God told Isaiah, go tell him, instruct your household, for you shall die and you shall not live. Right? Put your affairs in order. It's over. That's what the prophet says to him. Chizkiah says back to Isaiah, Isaiah, normally one goes to look after the sick. One says to him, they shall have mercy upon you from heaven. Right? God should have mercy. You pray for him. And the doctor goes to him and says to him, eat this, don't eat that, drink this, don't drink that. Right? You give recommendations, medical suggestions. And even if one sees that he is dying, one doesn't say to him, instruct your household, lest he become upset. And here you tell me, instruct your household, for you shall die and you shall not live. He says, you know, Isaiah, what are you doing? Where's your bedside manner? How could you come to me with such a message? Now, there's a PS to this story. The PS to the story is that Chizkiah is dying because of a particular decision he has made. He decided he wasn't going to get married because he didn't want to have children. Because he had been informed that his son is going to be a terrible king and lead the Jews astray. So he had decided, I'm not going to have children, and that way there won't be any problem. And he prays to God, and he says, I'm going to get married. And he says to Isaiah, let me marry your daughter. And he ends up marrying Isaiah's daughter, a woman by the name of Hephzibah, and they have a son. And he lives. Chizkiyahu lives beyond this point. So he actually does survive. The prediction was wrong. And then his son turns out to be Menashe, who was a king for 55 years, the first 22 of which are spent trying to lead the Jews into idolatry and so on. In other words, it all came true. But it's not for you to decide, I'm going to manipulate the world. You do what you're supposed to do. That's the message of that story. But going back to this passage, Isaiah is rebuked for conveying this to him. So this is what's been taken historically as the approach. I brought you in source number 12, one ruling from Rabbi Bezalel Stern. You can see the story of the Jews in the 20th century in his biography. If you see the top line there in number 12, he started out in Hungary. He ended up in a DP camp after the war in Italy. Then he was invited to Australia to start a yeshiva. Then he went back to Vienna to be a rabbi, and then he finished out his life in Jerusalem. This is the Jews of the 20th century. And his argument is you don't actively trick a patient entirely and say, no, you're fine. You tell him things are serious and he should pray, but you don't give him the full news about his situation. That's been the Jewish take historically. And it fit, as I said, the secular approach going all the way back to the Greeks. Right? The approach of Plato, the approach of Hippocrates, was a very paternalistic approach. Not just in terms of patients and doctors, but in terms of society. The people who know what they're doing will run society, and everybody else should be grateful. That's the way the world should operate. I know a lot of politicians who still think that. But take a look at source number 13, Hippocrates giving his instructions. Fulfill your obligation to the patient in tranquility and for his benefit. Most matters should be withheld from the patient when you treat him. Instruct the patient in a pleasant and positive manner, but divert his mind from what is being done for him. At times you must deflect the patient's mind in a sharp manner, whereas other times you should calm his mind, but without revealing to him his true condition or the prognosis. You don't want to tell the patient what's going on, and that, as you saw, persists until the 19th century. Right? That's what's going on in 1868. Some of the ideas behind it changed in terms of why this is so, but fundamentally, the idea remained at its core as it was in the days of Hippocrates. Autonomy is not an issue. The experts are the ones who decide. And the idea that bad news could harm the patient was very much a Greek idea. I brought you a piece here from source number 14 from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy on something called hylomorphism. Hylomorphism, it might be it's hylomorphism, I'm not sure, but I think it's hylomorphism, refers to the idea that body and soul are fundamentally of the same material, so to speak, but the body is, as you see here in the paragraph, the matter of the soul. It's about matter and form. And without going into a whole bunch of Greek philosophy that I don't really understand, I can just use the words and pretend that I'm understanding what I'm saying. But the fundamental idea is that body and soul are part of a single entity, and if you harm someone's emotions, you weaken their body at the same time.
So isn't that really our approach as well?
Our approach meaning what?
That it's all part of the same.
But I mean Jews or contemporary life in general? Jews. So, not really the same approach, meaning we have a concept of a neshama as separate from the body.
But
they work in tandem.
Yeah.
Definitely that they work in tandem, without a doubt. But this really, fundamentally, is a theory that's invented to explain observable reality. Right? Because it is observable reality. It's what we call stress. Right? The reality is that stress occurs because of our emotional, psychological response to something, which triggers a fight or flight reaction within the body, which impacts all of the different services the body is running physically. Negative reactions to stress include responses from the cardiac system, right? It raises your heart rate, raises your blood pressure. It changes the metabolism of fat and protein. You can get elevated blood sugar. Your immune system goes haywire as it anticipates infection and tries to fight it off. But on the other end, it's trying to channel its resources towards the fight or flight response instead of towards the immune system. In the brain, there are reactions to this in terms of narrowing a focus to be able to deal with the problem at hand. All of the body's systems, physiological systems, respond to stress. Now, it's true that there is, in the realm of psychology, a concept called eustress, right? E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S. Hans Selwey was the one who coined the term. It's the idea that if a person reacts to stress with a philosophy of, I can take it, I can deal with it, they'll do much better. And it can actually be a positive for them. But that's hard for people to do. And so the argument historically was, there is a negative response, and therefore, I don't want to be in that position. I don't want to, I don't want to know, and other people shouldn't want to know either, and therefore, we're not going to tell. Clear? I apologize. I didn't realize what was going to be going on, that I gave such a morbid topic and ended up with this for now. But that's as it is. But in terms of the psychology of not giving bad news, historically, Jews and general society were on the same page. Now, there are two side issues within Judaism that you have to get into. And this comes back to the question that people have asked. How do you tell the patient? If you're telling me that you're not supposed to inform the patient of the bad news, how do you get the patient to actually acknowledge, you know, their sins? How do you get them to do vidui? So take a look at source number 15. But this is where the Talmud actually says that you're supposed to tell the patient. It says, for one who is ill and dying, they tell him. Now, there's a debate how to read this line. Either they tell him, admit, end of quote, for thus all who are to be executed admit, is just like a narrator's line in the Talmud. Others believe you're actually supposed to say this to the patient. But you simply tell him to admit. Tell him that he should have a conversation with God. The Code of Jewish Law offers you advice about how to get this done. 16. For one who is dying, they tell him, admit. And they say to him, you know, many have admitted and not died. And many have not admitted and have died. As a reward for admitting, you shall live. And all who admit have a portion in the next world. So in other words, you say to him, you know, it's a good idea to do this. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's imminent. The truth of the matter is, I had the most horrific thing happen when I was starting out as a rabbi. My first time that I had to go to a patient and actually do this with them was a young man. And I come to him, and he was observant and educated. He had gone to yeshiva. He knew, you know, what the rules are. Nonetheless, it's going to be a shock to anybody to have somebody come into the room and tell them this. So I had with me a book, a little book called Hamadrich. Hamadrich literally means... Well, the counselor, the guide. It's a book that rabbis have, certainly within Orthodox circles. I assume there's another version of it within non-Orthodox circles for the rabbinate. But basically, it has a digest of what you do for all the different life cycle events. So, you know, it has a guide for weddings. It has a guide for, you know, circumcision. It has all the things. It's like one-stop shopping in your book there. And it has the vidui. So I bring it with me. I had not looked at it before. But I go through my speech to this fellow, and I say to him, you know, I'm only telling you to do this because it's what people do when they're in a serious situation, but it doesn't actually, like, don't read anything into this. People do this all the time, and then they go on whatever. Which is true, because we make sure to tell it to them beforehand. You don't wait until they're in dire, you know, straits. And then I'm going to hand him the book with the text, and I notice at the top of the page that it actually says, when introducing this to the patient, tell the patient, many people do this and live, and whatever, it's all there at the top of the page. So I quickly tear off the top of the page. I have the book to this day with the top of the page torn out. Like, why did you put that there? Unbelievable. But take a look at source number 16. That's what they tell them, right? That's how you're supposed to do it. Sorry?
I can't believe they still do these things.
Yes.
What, be doing?
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense.
Well, there was a philosopher called my sister-in-law. It's 30 years ago. Worked with radioactivity in Constance. And she contracted leukemia. And her husband was a physician. Told his colleague to tell her that she has anemia.
So that she shouldn't know.
That she should know. So some people tell that she shouldn't know. Should have told her.
It's very hard. It's a very hard thing to do, to tell someone that kind of thing, and especially when you know you can't do anything. So what you're seeing here is, on the one hand, an imperative for them to know, because you want them to be able to admit it, to talk to God and have that conversation, but you don't want to panic them. So this is an attempt to try to hedge. The other imperative to tell is estate management. I brought you the passage in source number 17. This is also one of those things that you look at and think, it would have been fun to go to the doctor 2,000 years ago. The doctors have totally forgotten what real medicine is. Take a look at this. The sage Shmuel said, this is going back about 1700 years, if someone is struck with Persian lances, the Persians used to put poison at the edge of their spears. So if he's struck by that, he's not going to live. It's fatal. At this point, give him rich meat, barbecued on coals, and undiluted wine. Yeah, what happened to the good doctors? Perhaps he will live a bit and instruct his household. My point in bringing this is not so much because I think you're going to encounter this situation, as because you see that it's a value to let somebody take care of putting their affairs in order.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is that kind of desire, and we talked about, you know, making sure that people will be able to take care of their affairs. So the truth of the matter is that there's a long history of trying to tell people to take care of these things without giving them all the information. So this is all, everything we've discussed for the last 40 minutes is history, right? This is the way it was done in Jewish circles and in non-Jewish circles. And if you had a reason to tell, to get them to do the vidui, to get them to take care of their estate, whatever it was, then you found a way to get them to do that, and you avoided giving them the bad news directly. People are smart, they're going to figure it out, but they didn't hear it from you that way, and there's a level of uncertainty involved. They won't know for sure that you've given up. Well, things have changed. What's changed between then and now? Why are things different these days? We already saw the CPSO statement about patient autonomy. Why is it that the world no longer works this way?
Well, first of all, the computer. More than anything, patients can educate themselves and sometimes miseducate themselves.
Right. So part of it, well, that's two things in one, right? Part of it is patients are educated, and therefore you're not playing any games. Right? Patients know more or less what treatment looks like. right? If you're not doing chemo and you're not doing radiation and they're just getting painkillers and, you know, and food, they realize what's going on, or worse, right? The other possibility, which is even worse, they draw the wrong conclusions, right? It could be that right now we've taken a break in treatment because they're not tolerating whatever it is, and they come to the conclusion that you've given up, right? If you don't bring them in on it, you could actually be doing worse damage.
Yeah.
So that's another concern. What else has changed? Yeah.
I think it must be harder on the physician not to tell. Because, A, you've got to keep track. Who knows and who doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be arbitrary, and I'm not a doctor, but it seems to me that that's a major factor, that it's just too hard for the physician.
Yes, and that's right.
And I know of cases where, within our lifetime, where this sort of thing was done, and the physician afterwards said, I will never do this again, no matter for whom. It was just too difficult.
Right. See, one
or
of
it was, or maybe not too difficult, more difficult than that physician was prepared to.
No, I mean, Pearlie's point is well taken, and you'll see, we're going to see it in the literature as well. In today's hospitals, you have a dozen people involved in the care team. How in the world are you going to manage that? Right?
I know that the... I understand that the... So when doctors are trained, they are not trained in how to break this news to patients.
They're being taught that.
Because a friend of mine was wearing the course to lobbying to have this included.
Yeah.
And he said it's not included.
It's really still like now.
Well, this was.
I think Claire says it is. Yeah, it's
included in medical school now. I understand.
Well, that's fairly recent.
How to break bad news.
Good. I'm glad that they have included it. So there are a few changes. I mean, that has changed. First of all, that patient autonomy has changed is very, very clear. The idea that patients need to be informed. But here I want to go back to that point about the fellow in palliative care who insists that you have to tell the patient in order for the patient to make the decision. There is a shift in response against this idea of making the patient make decisions and trying to inform the patient, precisely because it's not as though they've now are up to speed on everything. Just because you had a conference with them when they're on medication, they're under stress, and they don't have a medical background, now you're going to have them make their decisions. It seems a little bit ludicrous. So there is an anti-patient autonomy shift at work as well. But fundamentally, patient autonomy emerged because of lawsuits. That's where this came from. Take a look at source number 18, please. Jonathan F. Will, A Brief Historical and Theoretical Perspective. He says, while physicians did develop a more consistent practice of obtaining patient consent in the early 20th century, the medical literature indicates that the practice was fueled more by a desire to respond to lawsuits than by a moral imperative to respect patient autonomy. In a 1911 article, physician George W. Gay suggested that, quote, careful and explicit explanations of the nature of serious cases, together with the complications, bless you, liable to arise and their probable termination, be given to the patient for our own protection. In Schloendorf v. Society of New York Hospitals, Justice Cardozo planted the seed for what would become the informed consent doctrine when he wrote, every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body, and a surgeon who performs an operation without his patient's consent commits an assault, for which he is liable in damages. So there you go. Now you have a problem. You better get the patient to consent. That's your doctrine of autonomy right there. Plus the sense that it's essential for human dignity, but frankly that came later. The autonomy was born out of lawsuits.
Yeah, for sure.
The other change, that's, yeah.
The chief says here, of sound mind.
Yes. But then if not, it's not for the physician to make the decision, it's a substitute decision maker who will be called in. But that's one change, right? I'm talking about why this is a new issue. So one change is the change in the law. The other change is the change in psychology. And here, it's two more changes, but one of the remaining changes is a change in psychology. I brought you a piece from an article by Dr. Judah Goldberg called Towards a Jewish Bioethic, The Case of Truth-Telling. He is very much in favor of telling the patient everything. And he makes an argument here, which I have to admit I do not agree with. I contacted him about this, and he walked back some of the stronger statements in this paragraph, but I think it's worth reading it. Source number 19. He says, regarding the interplay between psychology and biology, the idea that you give someone bad news, it's bad for them. The gap between the outlook of Chazal means? Chachamenu Zichronam Levracha, our sages. So he says, the gap between the outlook of our sages and the perspective of contemporary medicine is multidimensional. First, whereas our sages breathed and functioned in an essentially Aristotelian world that took the seamless unity of both existence and knowledge for granted, modern science operates with a fractious intellectual outlook that utterly forbids the mixing of spirit and material substance. In other words, the mind is here, the body is there, one doesn't affect the other. Accordingly, while our sages might have embraced spiritual or psychological explanations for disease, contemporary medicine insists upon organic theories. Stress as the basis for stomach ulcers has been replaced by bacterial infection. Freudian descriptions of neurosis have given way to hormonal imbalances in the brain. The same holds true for the hypothesis that any degree of mental distress can be lethal for a fragile patient. What for our sages might have seemed intuitive to the point of obvious is at best eyed with wariness by modern medicine and at worst with derision. So when I presented this to the physicians, most of them reacted much the way I heard people here reacting, which is, that's silly. Of course there is a physical reaction to an emotional state, and stress is perhaps the best example of all for that. And like I said, I contacted him and he walked back the extreme nature of it. He didn't mean to say there's no such thing as a mind-body relationship. At the same time, what he is suggesting is a fundamental change in the belief that bad news is uniformly bad for patients. And the argument is made today that doesn't have to be the end of the world. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is famous for her five stages of grief. So so she did a study on 200 patients who went through this kind of a process. And she found that all of them achieved acceptance in the end. And she said there was no physical deterioration as a result of receiving bad news. That's her sense of it.
I believe her, but what's the criterion? I mean, how can you tell?
Yes.
There certainly was physical deterioration in that period.
Yep.
So how does she know what it's from?
So one objection to her research is to say this is a very hard thing to do scientifically. Mm-hmm. How in the world do you tell where their deterioration came from? That's one problem. The second problem, Rabbi J. David Bleich makes this point, is that the concern is not that all patients are going to hear bad news and be affected, but some. So even if her 200, even if you stipulate that her 200 were not affected, who knows what happens to 201? Unless you say, well, that's one in 201, when you play this out by the thousands and millions of people who are involved in this situation, you end up with an awful lot of people who can be harmed if you believe that there can be harm from this. That's the argument in response. But right now we're just going through what's changed. And the idea that bad news is going to harm the patient is something that has come into question. And then the last change is, as has already been noted, the way modern medicine works. Patients have access to medical information online. Patients draw incorrect conclusions. You have team care, multiple caregivers, and it's very hard to keep a secret. You know, even when a woman is pregnant, it's hard to keep a secret about what the gender is when she says that she doesn't want to know. You know, the technician on the ultrasound may give it away by accident. The nature of treatment today is also such that, as I said, patients can tell the difference between palliative care and therapeutic care. So the result of this change is that the world looks at the issue differently now. And so the question is, how does Judaism deal with this? We've been taught for 2,000 years since the Talmud, and we have examples that are biblical that go back even before that, of not telling. what do we do today? So in terms of the shift regarding patient autonomy, there's a split where J. David Bleich and others say, no, autonomy does not hold sway. We don't accept the idea of autonomy to give somebody a right to this information. You don't have the right to the information. This fellow, Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg, disagrees. He brings it in number 20. I'm going to skip the text inside, but you can see it for yourself. He says, no, he makes an important point that I do have to mention. I'm sorry. He notes something that actually is very important. We had the source earlier. Excuse me. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who we quoted way back, said that you follow the doctor where the injury to the patient is clear, the disease is clear, and the doctor knows what's wrong. So Judah Goldberg points out that's not the way medicine works anymore. There's no such thing as certainty in medicine. You know, you do the best you can, but there's no such thing as certainty anymore. And so, you know, he talks about having different consultants weigh in, and this one says this, and this one says that, and at the end of the day, the physician has to make a judgment, but he never declares that he is certain. And so that's one argument for patient autonomy, is the doctor isn't really sure. And that's one point that's made. In terms of the issue of stress harming the body, so, you know, again, there are different positions on this. Rabbi Bleich, I brought you his response in source number 21, where he says, and he invokes various studies that he has seen in his article. I didn't bring it all here. But he brings studies that show that there are patients who indeed are harmed by this. And by the way, since that time, there have been studies done more recently that have shown, or claimed to show, that patients who receive the bad news are indeed harmed. Their health is harmed by the fact that they did not have access to the information. So this is still...
Wait a minute, could you repeat that?
Yes, studies have been shown. Maybe afterwards I'll email out one of the studies that I received from a doctor friend of mine. Studies have been done that have indeed shown, or claimed to show, that that patients have a reduced quality of life, and even possibly quantity of life, when they have received the news that they are in fact terminal.
Okay. There was a contradiction in your follow-up.
Okay, so now I've hopefully clarified. Yeah.
Rabbi, what does a doctor do when there's a procedure? You can offer a procedure to a patient, and there's risk in the procedure that there's no guarantee of an outcome. And to leave the condition alone might be no worse than doing the operation.
Correct. So there the doctor has to inform the patient of everything. The patient needs to know what the options are, and the doctor is expressing uncertainty. That's not the same as a doctor saying to a patient, yeah, based on my experience and knowledge, you've got X number of weeks. That's different. In a case where the doctor says, you know, look, here are the odds, you know, the odds of making it off the table and the odds of it being a success and so on, you know, the doctor needs to inform the patient of that in the best way possible, but the doctor needs to inform the patient, you know, very clearly of what's involved.
And another general question.
Yeah.
Does if you're dealing with a 30-year-old man and an 80-year-old man, do the same rules apply?
What do you think? Why should I? No, but why should I?
I want to learn. I don't know.
So from my perspective, some of the factors that we're talking about will apply differently to a 30-year-old than they will to an 80-year-old. Some of the issues that we're talking about, everything from if there are young children involved, being able to take care of them, being able to have that closure with them, you know, that's so important, where if you don't tell him, he's not going to be able to do what he needs to do, to the issue of the family being able to cope and being able to have the conversations they need to have. You know, I think those are really important points that may argue for treating the 30-year-old differently than we would treat the 80-year-old. Not to mention, the fact that the person who is younger may have a harder time drawing the conclusions from what's going on. You know?
The person that's older may really want to know.
But also may be able to figure it out. Having lived life longer and having had certain expectations, they will, you know, be more apt to be able to recognize what's going on than somebody who doesn't have the benefit of that, you know, of that life experience.
Okay.
So you have the change in patient autonomy, which, again, some are very willing to accept, some are not willing to accept. You have the change in terms of the view of stress, which, again, some are more willing to accept, some are less willing to accept. But what is clear, and they are forced to accept, is the change in the way medicine works today. And that's what really defines this. If you flip the page to the last page, source number 22, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, who, keep in mind, we've talked about him before on medical ethics issues, is not only a rabbi, but was the head of internal medicine at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital for decades. So he says, even though he and his mentors were very against telling, he says, but today it is very hard to hide from a cancer patient the nature of his illness. And especially as most of them are treated via radiation and chemotherapy or in an oncology unit or clinic. Further, thank God, the success rate for treating these patients is increasing. And in many cases, they can not only extend the patient's life, but actually completely cure his illness. So you're not giving him a death sentence when you tell him what's going on. And if they don't directly inform the patient of the nature of his illness, along with the hope of his treatment, he will certainly think the worst of his situation, right? As Helen had said before. Just the opposite, lack of knowledge, and worse, wrong and deluded knowledge, will bring him to despair and depression. On the other hand, when they tell him of his illness, he will be able to reveal to the doctor his thoughts and fears, and an open conversation will be possible to encourage him and give him the emotional support, which is so important and necessary. So that's a major change in the way the world works, and it results in a major change in the way business is done halachically. In terms of the way that we deal with patients, there's a much stronger push, largely because of the facts of modern medicine, to inform the patient. So I brought it for you in source number 23 as well, this idea. And Rabbi Yigal Shaffrin, who writes in 23, makes one more point that I want to highlight here. He notes a law which we've had on the books forever, since the times of the Talmud, but it takes on new light when you think about this issue. A woman is giving birth. It's Shabbos. She's scared. There's a midwife there. She says to the midwife, "You don't have enough light to be able to work. I want there to be a light turned on. You know, whatever. Someone should turn on a lamp so that you'll be able to see." What's the law? What's the halacha? You turn on the light. She is viewed as being in a life or death situation. You do not want her dealing with anxiety at this moment in time. You turn on the light. Follow up question: what if she's blind? What if she's blind?
Yeah, but she wants a midwife
to see.
It's not her thing.
Right, the midwife knows that she has plenty of light. The midwife knows that she already has plenty of light. What do you do?
You tell her that you turned it on.
So Miggy says, you tell her you turned on the light.
Yeah.
Take a look at the Code of Jewish Law in source number 24, recording what the Talmud says. A woman who is giving birth is like a dangerously ill patient, and we violate Shabbat for any of her needs, and we light a lamp for her even if she is blind. Yeah. Says Rabbi Shaffrin, why don't we just tell her the light's on? She's not going to know. And his answer is, because if they know that this is our practice, if they know that we deceive, then they're going to come in with anxiety because they expect that their wishes are not being fulfilled. Yeah. Says Rabbi Shaffrin, the same thing is true here. If patients know that we're not honest with them as a matter of policy, then they're not going to trust the things that we're telling them. And it's going to undermine everything.
Didn't you just say a little while ago it's okay to lie, and you're instructed to lie in certain circumstances?
So he said that when you're dealing with a patient who is dying, you avoid telling them that they are dying. You say, you know, many people have done this and have lived. And without doubt, what you're doing is stopping short of telling them everything while still conveying to them that their position is serious. But I think he sees that as different from the case here where it's really binary. Either the light's on or it's off. How can you in any way shade this, so to speak, when dealing with the woman who's giving birth? You don't have other options. It's either a yes or a no. So I think that's why he comes out that way. Whereas he feels like you can find ways to deal with somebody, and you're right. I mean, fundamentally, he's coming out on a different side of the equation, but I think it's because your choices are different in the circumstances that he's talking about.
It also becomes a question of which is the bigger sin, the turning on the light or the lying.
Well, this is true.
If the lady giving birth is blind, how does she know what the light is on or not?
Right, no, that's the point. That's exactly the point. But we're saying turn it on. We're saying that you turn it on for her. And so even Rabbi Bleich, in the last source on your sheet, who is staunch in his belief that you shouldn't tell, nonetheless, he says, nevertheless, in the real world, there certainly are exceptions. First, an exception must be admitted in a situation in which disclosure is necessary in order to secure the cooperation of a patient in his treatment. Second, there are situations in which the patient is bound to discover the truth and he may learn the nature of his illness in circumstances that will cause greater harm. So fundamentally, they're not accepting autonomy. They're not accepting that change. And Rabbi Bleich isn't even accepting the change in psychology, saying that now stress doesn't harm patients. However, he recognizes the change in the way medicine works, and on that basis changes the answer that he's going to give. Mind you, not for all situations. In the event that there's nothing you can do for the patient, he doesn't want you to tell the patient that coldly. He doesn't want the patient to hear that kind of news in that way. Unless, again, you can provide a justification in terms of some need where the patient needs to be aware of this, such as the case that you mentioned, the 30-year-old versus the... But it's interesting to see the way that hospices deal with this situation. Vita.
What about the doctor telling the patient's family or the patient's wife that...
Right. So they're much more comfortable and even recommend telling the family of the patient. They want the family to be told. I think I even had a quote here where did I do it? It was Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham. And you know what? It's not on the sheet. But he actually specifies not telling the patient, but telling the family. He talks about the family specifically. He's not the Canadian Medical Ethics Code. He says to tell the family that they should be aware. There's also an interesting article by a Dr. Batsheva, I'm forgetting her last name, there's a journal in Israel of medicine and Jewish law called Asya, and she wrote a piece in there in which she talked about the importance of when you're going to tell the patient, let it be the family physician and not the attending in the hospital. It should be someone who has a long-standing relationship and knows the patient and knows the family and knows what to say, as opposed to somebody who's on the clock, walks into the room, has 5 minutes to spend there. Right, I said five, I'm generous. It should be somebody who knows them well, and it should be done with proper thought and sensitivity, and not just some kind of a cold, here's the news. Type of an approach. So that's an important point in terms of how this is actually done, if it is to be done at all. I want to make the hospice point, and then I'll take the further questions. I looked online at different hospices and the way they describe themselves, and I saw Toronto Hospice. And Toronto Hospice's approach is to be very clear about who they are and what they are doing. Their slogan is adding life to days. Right? As opposed to adding days to life, adding life to days. We recognize life-limiting diagnoses, as they put it, and what we want to do is improve the quality of one's care for that period of time so that they won't be in pain, so that they'll be at rest, they won't have to deal with the hospital issues and so on, and it could be in-home, it could be inpatient, and so forth. Then I saw...
Wait,
There are so many palliative care units. What is Toronto Hospice? Is it a building or is it a
No. Hospice? No, it's a service. It's a hospice service. They have inpatient and they also have home care. Sorry, you were going to say, Claire? Yeah. Oh. I don't remember the specifics anymore of it. I looked it up a couple of weeks ago, and I looked up so many different hospices. I don't want to get it wrong, but you can look up Toronto Hospice, and you'll see it. The other one that I really noticed was something called Omnicare Hospice. They're in the U.S. And in their explanation of what they do, they emphasize the significant percentage of people who come into hospice and come out of hospice.
What?
There are people who come into hospice and leave, live discharge.
Yeah.
It happens. Either because the doctor made a mistake in the prognosis. You know, in order to qualify for Omnicare, the doctor has to give a prognosis of less than 6 months. So sometimes they're wrong, and the patient survives, and the patient, you know, they may still have the same illness, and they may be back at some point.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, the idea that people can be a live discharge is emphasized by them on their site. And I think that speaks to what we're talking about here. Yeah, to give some sense that there can be hope. It isn't as though this is their sentence. And again, in some situations, that may not be appropriate. In some situations, that may be destructive to give a patient hope where they really, you know, shouldn't be. May be a mistake. But as a general rule, our preference is for people to have the option of at least telling themselves it may not be this way. You know, we do that in other areas. You know, I have a friend who, because of an accident, is no longer able to walk or even, to a large extent, move his arms and so on. And he was told by the doctor after, you know, the initial round of the spinal surgeries, you're never going to walk. It was the most horrible thing to say. Mm. You know, you can say, I don't think that this is going to happen. You can say, you know, in general, patients with this kind of an injury don't walk again. But to just block off all hope of that happening, you know, he happens to be a very strong person. And so ultimately he decided, I am going to. And he does the physical therapy and who knows where it leads. That's a really, like, you know, you recognize that giving that kind of finality can be a very harmful thing. Bev, you were going to say?
Yeah.
I sorry to come back to
Yeah.
The word admit in a couple of instances here, there are quotation marks in that. And I'm not quite sure I understand what admit means.
Yeah.
It's almost like saying confess.
Right, so it is
Catholic way of confession.
Precisely.
But does this mean admit that you are going to pass away and do all of the prescribed rituals that go along with it, like speaking to God or whatever it is that you suggested is an essential part of the dying process, or does it admit all of your sins and ask for forgiveness?
So, right, it's a good question. Admit here, first of all, you are 100% right. The other potential translation for the Hebrew word is confess, and I did not use the word confess because it's so Catholic. But the same word pertains. Keep in mind that basically every idea that the church ever had came from us. Mm-hmm. So it's not should not be a surprise that you're going to find a sacrament which has its model in the Talmud. But the idea of admitting one's sin before death is the same as for Yom Kippur. You turn to God and you say, if you remember the paragraph in the traditional liturgy, Ashamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu, right? We have done this. That's the core text. That's what we're talking about. For a person to do that to God and to say, I'm sorry for the things that I've done, and I hope that whatever I'm going through right now will at least atone for my sins. That's the idea. The key difference is, between us and what the Catholics are doing, is that we don't have any need to do this to the rabbi.
Yeah.
You know, it may be the rabbi's job to let the patient know that there is such a thing, but this is a conversation between the patient and God.
We don't need
and you have no guarantee that that you will be absolved.
No, Catholicism,
you get absolved.
Right, no, we don't have any guarantees. Pearlie and then Harvey.
I was given the Dewey to read before I was married.
Right. Well, there's a reason for that, too. You can draw whatever analogies you like.
But the point is that it is not a strange thing to do.
Right.
It is a very normal
thing. Right. No, it's true. Meaning, for a traditional Jew, this is very much something that they are familiar with. For that matter, you know, there's a difference between Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Sfard. Nusach Ashkenaz, which is what I grew up with and still do, is one form of prayer, but Nusach Sfard, which Hasidim have, which Jews from certain areas have, they actually say this every morning as part of services. And the school where I am based every day and where I am in the morning for prayer, that's the way they daven, that's the way they pray. So I end up saying this daily, and it bothers me, because then come Yom Kippur, it's not fresh and different.
So
it doesn't have the same value for
you're
me.
You're confessing sins every day? Is
yeah.
That what you're saying?
I'm a sinful person. That's just the way it is. I've got a lot on my record.
I suspect it's not too long ago.
But yes, it's a daily thing at that point, in which case it's not a shock for somebody to be told, you know, do this, because it's part of life for them.
Yeah. Right. I have to say, I'm sorry for
go ahead.
The recent magazine that came from Mount Sinai talks a lot about the Tammy Latner College Care Center. I like the point, both, we happen to know them out of experience, I'm afraid, but to what you said before, to add light to their days rather than days to their life. Yeah. It's not sort of watching them die, it's making the time that they're waiting more meaningful.
Yeah. Correct.
So adding life to their days, I like that.
Right, and I know some physicians who are in the Temi Latner system, both the home care and, you know, well, home care really.
Just to say, an unusual, with Gurion Oliver Sholem, there's a Dr. Bernstein, a neurosurgeon, at the Toronto Westers, who took the time to come and visit Gurion often, and became part of, for a surgeon to become part of the Tammy Latner College of Care Center.
From another hospital.
Yeah, that is good.
But there's a thing. Gurion is an example. 2 years ago,